Our second speaker, Mr. Lawrence Silberman, was born in Pennsylvania, educated at Dartmouth and Harvard, and has several years' experience in the private sector and in Washington. He has served in the Department of Labor, in the Justice Department. He was the ambassador to Yugoslavia under President Ford, special envoy to the ILO, and he was briefly the chairman of the transition team for the CIA under President Reagan, a story which you may want to tell you. For the last few years, he has been in Washington as a partner with Morrison and Forrester. He has served on the board of directors of the Committee on the Present Danger, and as Stan Evans mentioned, he is also a member of the General Advisory Committee on Arms Control and one of the authors of the report on Soviet violations of arms control agreements, which you may have read about recently. Mr. Silberman.
Forgive me for speaking with my jacket off, but it's hot up here. It's hotter after Stan spoke. As a matter of fact, I was trapped into speaking second. The chairman said it was alphabetical order, and I didn't realize until after Stan started that there was probably no way in the world that we could prepare to talk about this subject and not be prepared to cover exactly the same thing. So I have to do some quick dancing around, not repeat it. But in a way, I hope it's complimentary, because Stan Evans talked very strongly about the Soviet challenge, and I'll talk a little bit more about our response and put it in a question of balance. And perhaps I should ask the question whether our position vis-a-vis the Soviet challenge. Incidentally, I really ought to stop and explicitly state that we have both assumed what the chairman said, that the challenge to the United States comes from the Soviet Union and Soviet imperialism. When he did mention that, I stopped and thought that there was a time not too long ago when Jimmy Carter was president when it was seriously argued, that the major challenge to the United States came from the North-South client, not North-South conflict, and not from the Soviet Union. So I guess one should count one's blessings. At least we've gotten back to the view that the major challenge to the United States comes from the Soviet Union. But I'd like to take only a few minutes and talk about how are we postured vis-a-vis that challenge. What is the balance of forces, or as the Soviets would like to say, the correlation of forces between the United States and the Soviet Union? And by the United States, I include our allies. By the Soviet Union, I include their satellites. What is the balance in 1984 as compared to 1981? And I think when you look at it carefully, there are some sobering matters that come to mind. When one talks about the balance of power, it seems to me there are three factors to keep in mind. First of all is military capacity. And by military capacity, I refer also to whatever economic capacity is necessary to sustain a military capacity for so long as it might be used. And that, incidentally, is a very difficult question in terms of military planning, because no one knows for sure in the event there would be a confrontation with the Soviet Union, a conflict of one kind or another, what kind of economic support would be needed for how long. The most sophisticated kind of war planning the United States does is very difficult in a nuclear world, even when one postulates a non-nuclear confrontation. But in any event, one must first start with military capacity when one talks about balance of power. And that's never changed going back to the dawn of man. The second factor one must keep in mind is doctrine. I use the word doctrine because I think it's better than policy. I'm not talking about just foreign policy, just military policy. I'm talking about doctrine, political military doctrine in its broadest sense. And thirdly, and particularly in a democracy, one must look towards what political consensus do you have behind a viable doctrine, or whatever doctrine you have. Those three factors are crucial. Now, let's first talk about military capacity, U.S. versus the Soviet Union, U.S. and its allies versus the Soviet Union and its satellites. Look at it in 84 as compared to 81, when the president came in. And I will be brief on this because I cannot take the time to go into detail. We do not yet have the only strategic system we've developed since the 60s, if you put aside the B-1 bomber, and that is the MX missile. And indeed, because of the enormous fight over the basing mode, even if we get the MX missile, it will be a vulnerable missile. There is no defense to it unless we get something out of SDI's Strategic Defense Initiative to connect with it. It will certainly be an improvement over the Minuteman, but it will not, unless there's defense added to it, it will not close the window of vulnerability that the President campaigned against in 1980. It's an important addition. I don't think, frankly, as I look at the political fights coming up in the Congress, I think the odds are against us. I think we're maybe the worst of all possible worlds. We may get 4 or 5 of them, or 20, instead of the 100 originally asked for. So that's a very troubling thing. The President in 1980 clearly saw what indeed my organization, the Committee on the Present Danger, had seen for years, which was that the window of vulnerability had opened. It was very dangerous in terms of the Soviet possibility of a first strike against our land-based missiles. And we are no further along in protecting against that than we were in 1980. It is true, the B-1 bomber is much further along, and the B-1 bomber is an important addition. But that MX, first of all, was stripped of any defensive capability or any mobility, which gave it some measure of invulnerability. And even yet, even that, with all that stripped off, we still don't have it, and it's very chancy indeed. And if you remember, it's all tied up by virtue of the administration efforts, quite legitimate efforts, to try to get consensus from the Congress. It is all tied up with arms control, which leaves the Soviet Union with the capacity to influence are going ahead with our only strategic system, our only new strategic system, for many years. That is to say, by playing the arms control game one way or the other, the Soviets can stop the movement of the MX, and they may not even have to. All right, so our military capacity, let me go on one other thing. Our Navy has been beefed up. That's a very important thing, both tactically and strategically. Still, we have gone nowhere near what one would have hoped have been possible in 1981. So our military capacity vis-a-vis the Soviet Union has not been significantly enhanced. Oh, it is infinitely better than it would have been if Jimmy Carter won the election in 1980, infinitely better than it would be if Mondale had won in 84. But if one looks at it from a broad historical vantage point, are we in significantly better shape vis-a-vis the Soviet Union in 1984 militarily than we were in 1980? The answer is no. Somewhat, but not much. Let me go secondly to doctrine. Remember, if you will, that in 1939, when Germany went to war and destroyed the French army and the British Expeditionary Force, a little known fact is that the French army had greater military capacity by every known measurement at the time, and even in hindsight, than the German army did. They had more tanks than the German army. They had better equipment. They even had better planes. Where the French fell down was on the next two factors. Number one, doctrine, political military doctrine, and two, a political consensus, or morale, if you will. Two fit together. And that has always been true in history. Now, what about our political military doctrine? When Ronald Reagan was elected in 1980, there had been a transition since World War II of the following steps. 1948, we had the doctrine of containment, the author of which was George Kennan. And you had a bipartisan consensus to it. My own view is that for all of its vaunted wisdom, it was fatally flawed because it never had an offensive component to it. Now, I don't mean offensive strictly in a military sense, and this is really a takeoff on what Stan said earlier. We're putting it in a slightly different context. But we went from containment almost inexorably into detente because the containment basically is a static defense doctrine, or an all-azimuth defense, defense all around the world. I'm talking about it in political as well as military terms. I think it made Vietnam inevitable. I think it made detente inevitable, because with that static defense, you almost had to postulate a situation that would change somewhat, because a static defense, historians and military strategists and politicians will tell you, can't possibly win against a strategic offense. And so it was almost necessary to postulate a change in internal Soviet dynamics that could lead you to accept détente. And what were the three factors on détente? One was arms control, treaties, agreements. Two, the notion of economic transfer between the United States and the Soviet Union, most particularly technological transfer, economic relations. And third, a sort of loosey-goosey, touchy-feely, we'll stay in touch in times of crisis, which the Soviet Union was always perfectly willing to do as long as we were losing in any crisis. We went to détente, and détente fell apart in a double pincer movement. Ronald Reagan attacked it very effectively in 1976 and almost ousted Gerry Ford from the nomination based on that issue alone. It's one of the few instances in American history where foreign policy played such a dominant role in an election campaign. 76, not 80 and 84 as much as it was in 76. And then you had Carterism. And I really have a hell of a time trying to put a doctrine to that, because it really was very confusing. Remember the inordinate fear of communism and so forth, but even in sort of hard-headed political military terms, it was very confusing, and indeed it changed. By the end of the Carter administration, it was coming back to notions which were more traditional, as the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan and other things that opened Jimmy Carter's eyes. But then the president in 1980 ran, and the initial language of many of the people that served in the administration suggested that the president was really fundamentally challenging the framework or the basis of all the doctrine, political military doctrine, back to 48. There was something in what he initially suggested that containment itself was inadequate because it had led almost inexorably into detente. And I could say Vietnam too, but it would take me to divert me for a while to explain that. I'll leave it for questions. But at no time in the last 4 years has the administration coherently set forth a doctrine which includes the offensive counterpart or possibility that would make our doctrine, political military doctrine, roughly symmetrical to the Soviet Union, which has made the possibility of symmetrical relations between the United States and the Soviet Union very difficult. Indeed, I am troubled that the aftermath of the political campaign of 84 may make us further away than we were before the campaign. I agree. I will give you a suggestion. I gave it a few years ago at a meeting in Hawaii in which President Carter was president, Phil B., a number of others. I said the primary doctrine, political, military, or foreign policy doctrine of the United States, primary, first doctrine, should be to seek, through prudent means, the disestablishment of the Soviet Empire. Notions which Stan was very close to. Through prudent means, to seek the disestablishment of the Soviet Empire. And I define the Soviet Empire, at least at this point, as including all parts under the control of the Soviet Union outside the Soviet Union proper. If I was present and could succeed, the first step, I would be perfectly willing to redefine the empire for the second phase. but certainly, I think that should be the doctrine of the United States, its prime doctrine. And I put to you, and I will get to it in a moment as we discuss Central America, which he did in detail and I will not, NATO and bilateral U.S.-Soviet relations. If that doctrine were accepted, if it were articulated, if the American people had an opportunity to vote on it at any time, and it were accepted as doctrine, and there were a political consensus behind us on that doctrine, that doesn't mean unanimity, but a political consensus, all things would be possible that are not now possible. If one looks, for instance, to the lack of political consensus in this country on issues such as Central America, I submit it to you, it's not because the American people can't quite decide whether the line should be drawn at acoustical mines in harbors or handbooks or some, or of that kind. The basic problem is a doctrinal problem. What is our doctrine? Now, Stan absolutely correct when he said our problem in Central America is Nicaragua. But isn't it broader than that? Isn't it perfectly appropriate for the United States to articulate as its first principle of policy to seek through prudent means, never risk beyond what you're worth taking at any time, although the risks are minimal in Central America. The risks in Afghanistan are much greater, and we can divert to that. But in Central America, the risks are minimal. Prudent means to seek the disestablishment of the Soviet Empire. I would add two other factors which are by far and away less important, but are important, but they would never conflict with the first two, or the first one. The second of which is to seek democratic governments throughout the world. And the third is a mixed political economic doctrine, which is to seek free trade whenever possible. If that was the doctrine of the U.S., and if we articulated it and discussed it, I think the possibility of political consensus on specific issues would be much easier, because the fight, the political fight over Central America, should be on that issue, not on silly little line drawing. It is perfectly obvious that even if you believe that it is possible to change through a combination of military, covert, and diplomatic pressures to change the Sandinista regime, which in fact is communist, but even if you believe it's possible to change that regime and turn it into a political democratic country, not inconceivable, even if you believe that, it is certainly the height of foolishness to describe your aims in law as not extending to the overthrow of the Sandinista regime. Because the only way you would have any possibility of leverage to make those kind of internal changes would be to present a strategic threat to the continued existence of the communist regime in Managua. I believe, however, that our problem there is an inability to discuss this in doctrinal terms. And if we could, many things would follow. Let me turn to bilateral U.S.-Soviet relations. I'm troubled there, too, in the aftermath of the campaign. It has been said by various people on our side that the single most important objective, foreign policy objective of the United States, is to reach an arms control agreement with the Soviet Union. Now, let me say right at the outset, even if you believed that was true, it's the worst possible thing to say. Because you've told the other side with whom you're negotiating that your primary objective is an agreement. Now, you don't have to be a diplomat. You can be a businessman, a lawyer. You can be anything and realize that when you're negotiating with somebody else and you tell him or her that your primary objective at all costs is to reach an agreement, you have diminished your bargaining power. I believe that is self-evident. I believe any 14-year-old should be able to understand that. And yet, as Stan Evans suggests, there's a gestalt in the country. There is a notion that arms control agreements are magic. And we see, and I am deathly afraid, we see the specter of detente coming back. And the cornerstone of that was arms control agreements. Now, I do not believe that arms control agreements of all kinds and all types with the Soviet Union are necessarily wrong. I am a profound skeptic. But I do think there are some areas where you can have effective agreements with the Soviet Union, although if they depend on interpretation by lawyers of written material, I would say no. The non-proliferation of nuclear weapons. The United States and the Soviet Union share a strong interest in preventing some other small country, some other country from starting a war between the United States and the Soviet Union through the use of nuclear weapons that neither of us knew from whence the origin. There are other possibilities. With respect to the Navy, our navies have had sort of private relationships and agreements, although never in writing, for years, which have been crucially important, so important that neither Navy has dared allow diplomats to get involved in it. It's perfectly possible, and incidentally, that's quite true about the Soviets. The Soviet Navy has never allowed its foreign ministry to get anywhere near its rules of the road agreements with the U.S. Navy. It's maybe possible that some of that could be even worked out with respect to the Army or the Air Force. We share an interest in not miscalculating in a time of crisis. Mainframe arms control agreements designed by us to reduce the necessity of our expenditures or to give us a safer world, however, are asymmetrical with Soviet strategy, which is to use arms control negotiations to reduce the threat to the Soviet Union, but never to restrict their expenditures. In fact, arms control negotiations in the United States have often been motivated by a desire on the part of the United States to have a justification not to spend money in certain areas. When you go into a negotiation with an opponent with an objective that is so asymmetrical, it is almost inevitable you will have great difficulties. Well, yet we see detente coming back. We see the centrality of arms control coming back. And what's so extraordinary about this is that a number of thoughtful people who have been involved in proponents of arms control agreements for many years are now coming to the view that technology alone is making it terribly difficult. Zbigniew Brzezinski said only 3 weeks before the debate that the nuclear freeze was a hoax. Stunning remark. It took forever to get somebody in the White House to put it in the president or the vice president's speeches. And it is a hoax. And I could divert back for a moment to talk about politics. In 1981, there was a question whether the Republican administration would attack the nuclear freeze. The Democrats had not as a party yet adopted it. And they were scared to death because they knew it was a hoax. A verifiable mutual freeze is like the Holy Roman Empire. Neither holy nor Roman nor an empire. But it was deemed wise tactics never to attack it because there were a lot of fine people who thought it was important. And the administration never really attacked the nuclear freeze, never went after it, and it was so vulnerable that it collapsed in the last 2 weeks in the campaign under questioning from largely friendly journalists of the vice presidential candidate Ferraro and the presidential candidate Mondale. It was stunning, and yet we never attacked it, or at least the administration never attacked it. Anyway, detente is coming back. It seems to be coming back because of in part the notion of the centrality of arms control. Once you accept that the centrality of our bilateral relations with the Soviet Union is arms control, you've accepted the premise, the primary premise of detente. But beyond that, there are other problems that are driving that. One of them is budgetary. They would like to have a justification not to spend so much on defense. There is a way in which we could cut our defense budget significantly without diminishing our defense capacity. I don't know if I dare say it in this room, but we could cut the salaries of our privates. So over 50% of our defense budget goes to personnel costs. We could cut our salaries of privates down to one quarter of what they are and reinstitute the draft. And I would dearly love to see it. In libertarian groups, it's always, I admit it's a tax. And I even want to make it progressive. I wanted to apply, since we only need one quarter of the age group, I wanted to apply only to the top quarter in terms of educational and physical capacity. Milton Friedman, I know you'll be mad at me. Finally, I want to make a point about NATO, and this is the last point for my 20-minute talk. And this goes back, NATO's strategy today, its very existence of NATO, is terribly dangerous to the United States. Terribly dangerous. NATO is a hollow shell of a military alliance. And it does not need to be. And it is not simply a question of money. In fact, money is the least of it. Again, it is doctrine. the NATO alliance as a military alliance, and if it is not a military alliance, it is nothing. A NATO alliance is absolutely, rigorously, pathologically defensive. I say pathologically because it is defensive to the point that it is not permitted to engage, and there was just something in the newspapers, I'm not talking about anything that's private, in terms of what General Rogers said just a few weeks ago, it is not even permitted to engage in counter-offensive planning. Now, if you postulate a situation where a vastly inferior military group put aside nuclear weapons entirely because we are at a disadvantage with respect to tactical or nuclear weapons, just talk about conventional. The Soviet Union has massive superiority over us, but if they attack in some area in Europe, it is quite possible that with the use of counteroffensive measures, we can make the risk for the Soviet Union so great as to increase deterrence. But at present, they have precious little deterrence. Of course, there's the nuclear trigger. And nobody knows at what point that's hit. And that is our present existence. Our present survival is based on that. But let me explain to you another problem which touches on the Middle East. If you have a crisis anywhere in the world, because the Soviet Union knows that our entire posture in NATO is defensive, that we do not in any way plan to threaten in time of confrontation their suzerainty over Eastern European countries with any means, it suggests to any Soviet planner that if you have a crisis in Korea, if you have a crisis in the Middle East, if you have a crisis in anywhere, you must at all costs feint at Europe and force us to send enormous amount of our supplies to Western Europe, because they have no downside risk of a conflict in Europe, except on the terms of the total nuclear problem. But if they're in a conflict with us or our surrogates either side somewhere else, you've already crossed that threshold. Basically, it is a doctrinal problem again. It is the fundamental defensive notion, political military notion in the United States and Western Europe, which has led NATO to adopt a strategy which is a recipe for potential disaster.